Mr. Nelson.
Well, I understand what you're saying about the windfall profit thing, and that came back and was a benefit, except that at the same time, you know, please consider that we are at that time, and it took us a while to get the project approved and move forward, but right now, by the end of the year, we will have that enhanced oil recovery project in operation, which took about that time frame to get it going. And it is a $1.2 billion project that we took the money and invested it in for enhanced oil recovery. So I'm not disputing at all about the windfall. But all I'm trying to say is that I want to be sure we have the impression that when we get this money, we're just not running off over here someplace else right now. We have reinvested it to try to gain additional oil. And of course it is to our interest, but it's also naturally to the interest of the state as well.
At the risk of sounding somewhat taking a position on tax issues, I think if you assume that the price of oil stays above the severance tax floor, with the current law, I can guarantee you that the state's share in terms of severance tax and royalties, which is now about 25% of gross value. Remember, we're talking about gross value now. We're not talking about net, you know, we're not talking about the rent that goes to Prudhoe Bay, that big pot above cost. We're talking about of gross value. I can tell you that our percent of gross value will change July 1 of 1987 in terms of severance tax. We will be getting less. Now, where the confusion comes in, I think, is that other taxes don't remain stable when you make that statement, nor do the costs of producing. So, but if that gives you some idea, 25% is a pretty big chunk of what we were considering the fair share. And that percentage will go down. That will decrease, that percent of gross value. But that's gross now. That's not of the net.
And
which
as
is what the net
down,
has been used as the basis.
When we, as we just now said, put about a billion-dollar project on the North Slope, our property taxes go up accordingly. So, you know, it may not offset the complete amount, and you're absolutely correct. If the law and if it stands the way it stands right now, there's no dispute about that, will amount to a reduction. I think everybody here realizes that. That's goes without saying. But, you know, we do pay property taxes. We do pay corporate income taxes, and our property taxes go up as we add more and more facilities to the North Slope, whether it's Prudhoe Bay or wherever it is. And there won't be more property taxes if we don't have our North income to, regardless of what kind of formulas we have, if it's going to exceed the return on investment here, we won't go with the projects. And again, I repeat, a very good project. The next project that could come on stream that's that close would be Seal Island. And that's like Endicott. And under, you know, you're talking about with the facilities at Endicott as property taxes, as well as the state royalty from that amount of crude oil, as well as severance taxes, that's going to be in excess of $100 million a year to the state of Alaska. And when I look at this over here, and we're trying to consider something that's going to reflect back a few million dollars, or $40 or $50 million over a period of time of 15 years, that don't somehow I can't adjust my perspective to that.
Go ahead. I just had a question on the property tax, and just a rumor that floats. It takes a long time for rumors to get to the southern tip of the state where some of us come from, but that the oil companies had asked for a property devaluation of value property on the slope of $1.5 billion or thereabouts.
That's not a rumor. That you're absolutely 100% correct. I can't account for the time delay to reach you from down south, but that's right. But this is, for instance, we are, when a piece of that is, when we add the enhanced oil recovery system in NGL, which is a miscible injectant, we will shut down the fuel gas unit, which puts out about 170 million cubic foot of gas a day that we use for fuel gas. We don't need that now when we built the new injection plant, and so therefore it's still there, and we are not paying zero on it, but we have as unit owners asked for a reduction in some of that. Now the total you say is $1.5 billion. It's a large number. It's on the order of magnitude of $1 billion overall. That is correct. That's right.
Representative Martin, you had a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Senator. I think we're getting to a broader aspect of the total picture, and one which is logged in. Have you anticipated, or could we have a picture of the capital investment in the North Slope and elsewhere compared to the servants that may be lost? We're going to leave it as it is, or if we're going to decrease as an incentive, then are we going to pick up on income and property? We're at 20 mils a day now at this for property.
Yes.
Then can we see a forecast? It seems to me from the Department of Revenue, if you break those down, how much we're having in each aspect of our oil tax, and I see property seems to be increasing on a regular basis. Can we expect that, and to what degrees can it will decrease?
Right. We have we do have estimates of the property tax. Obviously, that's an important cost in considering the feasibility. Yes, we do. One thing that we do not evaluate, though, which in terms of the big picture is, of course, the one of the biggest half, I guess, probably of the property tax comes from the pipeline. And now that there's a settlement, the depreciation schedule is. It's been set, so that tax is going to start declining. That tax base will go down relatively rapidly. So you have to trade that off against the, is that going to, is that depreciation schedule going to match the increased capital expenditure? Will the tax base in total go up or go down? Unfortunately, we don't evaluate that in our feasibility model. We're looking as strictly as though we were looking at one company on the North Slope that is strictly involved in production, has no interest in the pipeline, or may have. I think actually we do attempt to include some of those effects, but in terms of the property taxes on the pipeline and the property tax or income taxes paid by a producing company statewide, no. Our focus is strictly on the production economics.
In your evaluation here on taxes, and maybe Mr. Wright can give us a better idea, do we also calculate what local government gets? Because when I think of the states, what are we receiving from our resources, I subconsciously think where that also means what the take is for North Slope government or bounties or whatever. Yes. Would that be fair to consider that instead of saying 30%? When you say 30%, do you mean local governments take too?
When I say 30%, I'm looking at the total picture here. I'm talking about, first of all, gross revenues. In other words, gross property taxes, for example. Mm-hmm. And that is different than the net to state government, per se. Part of it goes to communities. And I think that if you throw that in, you throw in the corporate taxes, the 25% factor, the check attributed to your severance taxes and royalties, you get somewhere around a third, but don't quote me on it. We'll double check this.
Thank you, sir.
Gordon?
Mr. Chairman, I have a question about the analysis that Department of Revenue has done. Chuck, in your analysis of the incremental tax revenue from some of these proposals and the foregone production at the other end of the field, have you done any assessment of the present value of those two?
You mean discounted barrels divided into discounted revenues?
Well, the present value of foregone production compared to the present value of the revenue received.
Not really, no. It's strictly been in nominal dollar terms, and we have made no attempt to evaluate the timing of the impact of the production, the change in average expected production.
It would seem to me, from the state's point of view, the present value of the
enhanced recovery is relatively low compared to if we could get a big boost right now.
I think what I want to do here is, it's almost 11, just take 5 minutes and everybody can regroup their last set of questions on the ELF. We'll come back for until about 11:45 and then break and then pick up the separate accounting this afternoon. So why don't we take a short 5 minute break here?
Did you want me to come back after the break or
just a minute? We can come back to order. And I'd like to just spend maybe the next 35 minutes, and then I'm one of those advocates that you can beat the lunch crowd if you get there a little earlier than they do. I will note that during the organization, the last time I was up here, I was totally unable to convince anybody in the caucus to leave before 11:50. But I have control of this situation, so I'm going to leave on time. I've asked Deborah a vote to join Chuck up here so that we can have her expertise in getting through some of these questions. And perhaps we could start by one option that I've thought about and others that is not in here on the ELF, and that's just continuing the current situation where it just doesn't apply to Pluto. Is that, anybody really looked at that as an option, or what's the impact of that?
And essentially, the last option of eliminating the ELF, when we evaluated that, since our forecast is on a field-by-field basis, if you looked at the table, table 7 and 8, you could see what the effect on Pluto Bay would be of just eliminating the ELF. That was your question, right?
Well, right now the ELF factor does not apply to Pluto Bay.
Right. If you continued that's essentially what would be indicated in Table 7 and 8. And as you can see, over half of our average expected revenue increase of pursuing eliminating the ELF would occur. Now, granted, when we did this, all the other fields got the same treatment. So to the extent that production field-wide is impacted, there would be, this isn't, if we zeroed in on Pluto, the results would be somewhat different because the pipeline tariff is affected by total production, so there would be some production effects which don't show up. But if you want a rough idea, the information in those two tables gives you a handle on the effect of leaving the ELF at 1, if you want to call it that, on Pluto Bay.
So that's on, if I just tag it on Table 8, it's years 86 through 2005. It's just the first column titled Pluto.
Right, exactly.
Now the rest of these numbers to the rest of the fields would probably decrease if you allowed the ELF factor to be applied to
that's
them.
That's right. That's exactly right.
And is that measured in Table 7, that this is the disincentive or the number
yes.
of barrels of oil that may not be produced if you
yes.
allow that? That's the... Representative Grusner.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chuck, you've given us four options, and you've kind of indicated here that, yes, there could be hybrids on lines of the questioning that the chairman indicated here with these options. For my explanation, I guess, or for my, I might have to explain some of this to someone. On the first one, you fixed the floor at 80 cents.
Yes.
And then on your option three, the severance tax floor is set at $1.50 index for inflation. Now, how did you get to the $1.50? Is that based upon the inflation rate when the 80 cents was established to present? Or how did you come to the $1.50 when I'm explaining that to someone?
Yes, that's essentially a number derived from the inflation that's occurred since the 80 cents was approved when the floor was put in place. That number would vary, by the way, depending on what kind of a price index series. I did not develop the $1.50 myself, but that's essentially how it's derived.
Opportunity to review the testimony or the paper prepared by Tom Williams that was submitted by George Nelson into the record at an earlier meeting, but there's an interesting discussion on pages 23, beginning on page 23, where he does an analysis for a large field and looks at the company's perspective and drilling. If you have 500 development wells already in place, what are your considerations in drilling that next incremental well? And I was wondering to what extent your model would account for the tax or the loss of tax savings or however you want to look at it. This analysis by Williams indicates that as a result of drilling the 501st well, results in an annual savings of $166,000, and therefore there's a positive incentive to drill that well, which I think is an important consideration. We don't want to have our tax structure discourage appropriate development. So do your numbers when you're showing, like in option two, a loss of 28 million barrels, do you account for that phenomenon?
Yes, as a matter of fact, we do. I haven't read through Tom's example, but I don't see anything here about the cost of drilling that well. Tax costs aren't the only costs incurred. Specifically, our model specifies a cost function, a cost-production relationship, and we specify how much additional production you can get in increments, I think, of about 10 to 20 million barrels in increment. We'd have to have Roger perhaps explain it. But at the same, if you associate with that increment are going to be the costs associated with increasing that level of production. In other words, there's going to be some costs incurred to get that incremental production. And you compare that marginal cost with the incremental revenue you would receive from that increased production. Now, of course, the incremental costs include not only the out-of-pocket expenses for capital and labor, but also tax costs, because our severance tax and royalties, which are calculated model, are going to be directly affected by how much oil you produce. They're volume sensitive. At the same time, the revenue that you get is going to be affected by the taxes, too, right? Since your incremental revenue is going to be reduced by your cost. So we compare the marginal cost of adding an increment and the marginal revenue, and we continue to increment through oil production until those two are equal. The old the neoclassical marginal cost equal marginal revenue shows you how much oil additional oil you would invest in producing from the field given the price. So yes, we take it explicitly into consideration.
Okay. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Logston, when we're dealing with an oil field, and there's a estimate what the recoverable barrels of oil will be out of that, and the state sits down and tries to figure out what the production costs are going to be to work out a tax formula, do we or do we not base it upon the technology available that would give them the production costs, so we set our tax tables accordance to the production costs? Would we do that?
To the extent that we can, we attempt to use historical cost relationships to do that, yes.
Well, I was looking at that law.
So that doesn't, so no, we don't introduce, I don't think we, once again, I'd have to defer to Roger Marks on this, but I'm fairly certain we don't introduce a technological trend or anything like that.
Yeah, but the technological trend gives you the cost to produce and pull out of the ground the recoverable oil.
That's right, and as a matter of fact, over time,
and we know this,
the existing fields are.
So, if we go back to the Texas oil field example, where they looked at a 20-year field, and then technology, of course, has changed, and now this field has been running for 36 years, and we already know that the technology is changing now. Would tax structures change with the technology available, and also which might also reduce production cost and a greater number of recovery of oil that would not be there? You see what I'm getting at?
Yes, I do. Well, I guess the easy way to attempt to answer the question is to say that our estimates of enhanced recovery, that is recovery beyond primary and the water flood that's in place now, are based over the long run on an assumption of probably, well, it is. It's based on a certain percent of the estimated recoverable reserves under current technology, like maybe it's 50%. I'm not sure. Roger, excuse me. Do you recall what our what the rule is for the enhanced recovery in terms of recoverable reserve? But what is the maximum what is the maximum enhanced recovery that's achievable for crude oil? Yeah, so we that 92% of primary, and you need a price of about $150 a barrel. So that may be somewhat unrealistic. Do you have a more realistic oil price? What about with $20 oil? Do we know that? Okay. Anyway, that
I like your number for all.
I guess what I'm saying is we have attempted, I think, to at least account for the fact that if the price of oil is high enough, the companies will find a way to get the oil out of the ground, even though it might be quite costly to do so.
But, Mr. Nelson.
When you say 92% of the primary, what are you talking about? 92% of the total $22 billion in place? You see, we're going to recover about 44% roughly of the original oil in place. That's the $10 billion roughly. So now, you know, if you're saying that we're going to get another 48% of that other, then that's my question. Is that what you're saying?
What's primary?
Yeah, what is primary? Well, you say we're only going to get 92%. Never been achieved in my 31 years in the history of the oil business. Do you do that?
Well, the real price of oil is
never getting $150.
Let me bring this discussion back to Earth.
I don't think that we could do that even if oil was $1,000.
Let me bring this discussion back to Earth a little bit.
Mr. Chairman, I'm afraid that my question was in relation with the Texas field, in fact, the 20-year expectancy, and 136. And you're still going. That in the meantime, when they based the original tax structure on, they based probably upon the technology available and the cost of production. I was just kind of curious if you've been thinking in this in relation to the situation here, and if the tax structure should change as technology and more money is, or more recoverable oil is pulled out. My question has the figure of the oil reserve in the Texas field changed.
I'm sure it has, because technology has expanded the ability to recover the oil, so I'm sure it has increased. I just want to introduce one real, kind of more realistic number than producing another $10 billion out of out of the field, and that is, and this is a rough number, but basically for our last two forecasts, enhanced recovery is really giving us an additional 500 to 700 million barrels out of the currently producing fields. And that includes Endicott and Woodburn, which aren't online yet, but which we do evaluate this, using the marginal cost, marginal revenue approach, incremental investments beyond the ones deemed necessary to bring it into primary production.
Representative Martin.
Yeah, thank you. Mr. Chairman, I wanted to get back to a discussion I had with an individual after our September meeting, and in giving the scenarios of the past history we held at the Alaska Legislature and Department of Revenue developer formulas, it seemed to have been mentioned, I didn't grasp it, the individual who was involved at the time did, that we had planned, the legislators in those days had planned only on the potential of oil production decrease and increase, that no one ever took into consideration of a decline in oil prices. And I know that got us into a lot of problems for other reasons, energy packages and stuff like that. People thinking it would get up to $50 a barrel. But I was wondering if that could be reevaluated, because it seemed like the Department of Revenue did get involved and did give scenarios to the legislators that they should also think of the potential of decrease in oil prices. When you gave a presentation with the other man, he had a beard, that's all I remember the last time, but he gave us the graphs and all, and it was at that time he was saying all we were looking at was productivity and not the price of oil. Could that be corrected and evaluated to see if that was a major factor when the legislators got into separate tax rates and then got into separate accounting purchases of it? I think it's an important thing for me to know what the legislators at the Department of Revenue based their conclusions on, both aspects, production and up and down the price of oil.
Right, well, certainly I think the presentation last time indicated that the severance tax was conceived, the severance tax as it's currently in effect is targeted strictly to productivity, and I mean that's the way it works, although we did, there is the introduction of the price sensitivity of the so-called production at the economic limit, which since price was very stable at the time the tax was considered, it was not perceived as being an important issue. And I guess the idea advanced last time was that in general, as long as prices stay relatively stable, the per well productivity is a relatively decent measure of profitability, and that the more profitable fields should be expected to pay a higher tax burden than the less profitable if the state wanted to encourage the development of low productivity, somewhat less profitable fields. And you're right, with the advent of the potential for very low prices, this may change the context in which the tax should be viewed, and I think that's exactly why we evaluated, for instance, decoupling the floor from the ELF, for instance, in the case of assuring a minimum payment for the oil.
So you're saying that it was eventually was thought of, but no one took it serious, but now we're going to take that back serious.
Well, we in the Department of Revenue continue to feel that it's not the most likely case that price would become low enough that the cents per barrel floor and a falling elf would be a problem. On the other hand, if the state is concerned that it wants to establish some minimum level of tax that it wishes to receive for oil produced in the state, then that's kind of a different issue than whether it's price sensitive. They're related, but they're not exactly the same issue.
Thank you.
I guess I'd like to explore one idea that Mr. Nelson brought up here earlier that I hadn't really looked at, and that in terms of the option of the House Bill 545 or changing the curve by changing the exponents of allowing greater incentive for production of marginal fields and yet raising the rate on the productive fields, or basically on Prudhoe, the impact that that concept has on when you look at Prudhoe as a marginal field, and I hadn't ever gotten out that point, but I guess I'd ask the question, when do you look at Prudhoe as a marginal field? Is it after the first 10 million barrels or 10 billion barrels are gone? Is that the...
No,
where's an incremental?
No, effort? We're, of course, with the, take for instance the enhanced oil recovery project that's there right now. That's a tertiary recovery type mechanism. And we looked at that as a way to try to obtain some additional oil. We don't, then the incentive is completely gone because it was as a result of, and we applied for both the state and federal government and received approval for the project based on the windfall profits, as Representative Grusendorf said before. And of course, with the price of oil falling the way it did, by the time we got the project in, it has no benefit whatsoever from that particular aspect of things. So we're currently, what I'm trying to say is, looking at different ways, and in our research and development, in as well as, oh, and I say we, I mean we industry, of trying to find other methods of trying to produce. But as the prices and the economics go down and the revenues go down, then we squeeze back on those programs. You know, this year, for instance, it's just like, well, in the third quarter of this year, Standard Oil, that's what I'm talking about, we made $7 million in the third quarter. We paid the state of Alaska taxes far in excess of that amount of money that we made. So by virtue of the price climate that we're living in, we have cut back a lot of things. One of the things that we have cut back on is some of the projects that we were doing in enhanced oil recovery for future work, as well as did some of the other major companies, and we're concentrating more right now with that type of work on what we need to do right now to sustain and maintain the plateau and rate. So as time progresses, you know, not to the $150 a barrel, but anyway, way before that, we would be back trying to do something in that manner. We do have an ongoing R&D program, research and development, as all companies do, but it's cut back, and so then all you do when you cut it back is decide what your priorities are. And right now, at this point in time, when we've only produced, as of the end of October, 4.8 billion of the total, or about half, more or less, we're still, you know, we're still concentrating on the current efforts to try to maintain and sustain the million and a half a day. And we would take projects, and I know two of them that we just got through canceling, that do, we're working on enhanced oil, the extra 12 billion barrels, and we didn't cancel them, we deferred them, and we'll look at them again next year, and it'll depend on what the climate's like again. That's what happened. But yeah, we're looking at those, and it just depends on where we are with the revenues as to how much we and the whole industry will look at that, and we're not to that point where it's a crash program.
But I guess it's, you look at it two different ways. One, the example of East Texas field was that so much oil was planned to be pumped out in 20 years, and you've been pumping on it for an extra 36. And in Prudhoe, if you look at, there's the time marginal aspect, right? You pump the first 10 billion, and then you come back in the next 40 years or 20 plus 20 and work on the next 12. Or do you work on the whole 20 billion field all the time? You're trying to pump.
So you try to work on the whole 20 billion field at the whole time. Because when you come up with new technology, if you can get that in there, you will try. Yes, I see what your point is. And the enhanced oil recovery project, I said
we don't have the technology to get all of the 12 billion, and we'll never get all of the 12, we'll never get to the 92, and we're looking at more conservative numbers than that that's meaningful, and what we're going to get, we think, and it's in our report and the project that we submitted for approval with the state as well as the federal government, is much, much more conservative than that, but that we feel would be a piece of that, but it's a very small piece of it. But if I'm answering your question right, yes, now today we're trying to work on technology for the whole big piece, not just the 10 billion. But we're spending more time and effort on that first 10 billion to be sure we get that, and than we are on the other 12, and the amount of effort and the amount of money and time we spend on this other is going to depend on how much revenue we got coming in, because our immediate priority is to get barrels per day right now.
So instead of working on, if there's a scheduled life to the end of the field at some point, instead of working on how to extend that scheduled life out another 5 or 10 years longer, you're working on how to pump the oil out faster. In other words, keep the curve from declining so fast.
Oh, yeah.
So I guess a little bit of a follow-up from the speaker's point that from a tax policy point of view that we probably ought to concentrate on recovering the state's share within the scheduled time of the field rather than working on tax policies that would try to extend the life of the field. If it's your incentive to try to pump more oil within the 25-year life of the field rather than make it a 35-year field, we ought to take the same point of view.
Well, the difference in what we're talking about is a small percentage of the amount that we know that is there. And if you discourage us by putting, it's like get while the getting's good, if you will. What you'll do is discourage us from spending that money on this particular piece of the work in this project and try to take that money and look for some other area to invest it because we think, we'll be able to get a better rate of return and we'll be able to come up with primary reserves rather than working on tertiary reserves. I think, in my opinion, that would be a short-sighted approach to say, well, let's just get as much as we can right now and then if the future comes, well, it'll come. With respect to what Representative Grusendorf said, sure, I'm sure in that period of time, we all know since 1930, the tax structures have changed dramatically with respect to everything, in the oil industry included. But as they changed in those states, and Texas is where this is, it still was whatever it did. It was gave an incentive to the industry to continue to try to spend that money or to spend the money to try to develop those reserves. And that's all I'm saying here that we must do. Sure, other things are going to change in the next 20 years, and I'm sure the tax policies over the 20 years will change from whatever happens in the next year. But it all needs to be relative to what the industry can do, and we have to be afforded to do it in an economical fashion, I think that the protection of the state is seeing what the industry is doing, and if we're taking our money and reinvesting it here and trying to develop resources within the state, then we're not failing in our obligation and just saying that using the money elsewhere. And all I guess what I'm saying is we don't want you to impose some kind of a financial burden that would have us do that.
Oh, it's a fine balancing act.
I know. You're right. You're right.
We have a little problem of investing our money on our side, too. It's
wouldn't mind having
it. Deborah, you had a question?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment that I've been hearing since the beginning of these discussions that the ELF is, at least with the ELF and the PEL hearings and so on, intended to benefit marginal fields, but I've never heard a really good definition of what a marginal field is. And Representative Martin's point a minute ago that the price reductions may have been what the legislature may have been not considered by the legislature when the original ELF was adopted in 1977. That's one way a field that would seem to me can get to be marginal if the price goes down so far that it it reaches the cost of production. A second reason would be if the cost of production go up because of secondary recovery, tertiary recovery expenditures that weren't there for the first barrels. And the third way seems to me to be if production tapers off. And if the, as a policy question, I think you need to define what you mean by marginal if you're going to try to benefit marginal fields rather than more productive fields. I think Representative Martin's absolutely correct that in 77, because of the long stability in oil prices, whether it was the intent or not the intent to make the PPL and the ELF sensitive to price, it wasn't considered. It was the idea was that the cost of production would go up relative to that stable value, and that would make the field more marginal. And we've seen this year a close approach from the other direction. And I don't have a recommendation, but I think it's just helpful to focus on this sort of three different elements of marginal.
Well, it seems to me that I wasn't involved in all of it, but originally one of the discussions was to how to keep Cook Inlet out of the picture. And that's where the 300 barrels per day per well kind of came up with, and how to, and so we defined marginal based on per well production. And by taking that definition, I don't know how you get to the extra $12 billion in crude oil that's marginal but being pumped at the same time the first $10 billion is being pumped. That is not defined as marginal in any of the equations on the economic limit factor.
Well, it's marginal when we invest the money and the criteria we used as far as the economics were concerned, and part of that was with respect to the windfall profits tax, because at that point in time, only a tertiary project was exempt from that, and that had to be approved by both the state as well as the federal government. And the amount, with that being gone, I can assure you that that project is not even close to what we laid that out in the original economics for that thing at all. Because
it was very tax sensitive.
Yeah.
Mr. Harrison.
Well, cost sensitive and taxes are part of that.
Yeah.
All of it was not taxes, obviously.
I'm not sure if I'm speaking to your question or your point, but the alternative two that was evaluated here, the alternative ELF, does behave like the conventional ELF, even on large fields. It just does it slower. That's my understanding of it. That is to say, when productivity of Prudhoe Bay is substantially less than it is now, there will be an ELF. It will just be somewhat higher than it would have otherwise been. So the treatment, the preferential treatment of marginality is still in that particular alternative.
But it's based on barrels per day out of a well. But so producing these extra tertiary recovery barrels are going to come up in the same well that's already pumping 2,500 barrels a day.
Maybe not.
Maybe put it over in a well that only pumps 300 barrels a day.
Well, we may have to drill a brand new well to do that. You see, I don't know how many wells they put in their program. But right now we have, for instance, there's over 800 wells in Prudhoe Bay. 600 of those approximately are producing wells. A field of this size and relative to fields that I have experienced in similar to this, the 600 producing wells that we have now in both 160 and 80 acre spacing over a period of time are going to require additional drilling, and you're going to look at maybe another 1,200 wells, and you'll be down on 40 acre or 20 acre spacing like they are in other areas, because you're trying to maximize the recovery in that particular, and when I say 160 acres, then we reduce it to 80, 40, 20, to try to get that oil out of there. And if it's economically attractive on the drilling, and that's what this we were talking about could discourage the drilling, then we don't do that, and then we will be leaving some oil in the ground that we think we might be able to produce. So,
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I think the question that brought up is a very appropriate one. We're talking about what is a marginal field, and I've always looked at it in relation with the production of that field, and I've always thought in terms of barrel of oil as also tied in with the reserve that's there and the potential that's there. While somebody else may look at it in relation with a marginal field relation with dollars and cents and regulating the market and maybe ignoring the capabilities of that particular field and the reserve of that particular field. I like to look at the reserve ability and the production ability, not the market aspect of it. Of course, that's going to affect our formula, how many dollars we get, how many you get, but the market. And I think that's important that we discuss this. You know, what do we think is a marginal field? What is the definition of a marginal field? Mine might be different than yours.
Well, it's both. It's not, well, you hit on two of them. It's, in the oil industry, we don't look at the barrels of oil per day as it's looked at as the recoverable reserves. And the recoverable reserves are a function of the go down in size from the five, and that's recoverable, and until you get to 500 million and on and on. But it makes no difference. You're talking about the recoverable reserves that are there and the cost, as far as we're concerned, to develop those reserves. So as Seal Island, again, there are, in our, I'll use Endicott's, Endicott's ours, I'm familiar with that, but Seal Island is very similar. 350 million barrels of recoverable reserves, more or less, in Endicott. When that project was started and put into effect some 5 years ago, the price of oil and the economics we did on it, as you can imagine, were extremely different than they are today. We did not, because I participated in all that. And, well, others did it, but I reviewed it, approved it, and passed it on for other approvals, of course. But it did not take into account any way, shape, or form where we are today. And even at that point in time, you know, it met the hurdle rate that we set. Now, he sets in his program 8%. Each company's going to say what they think they need to do to meet their rate of return for their shareholders. Okay. But even at that, it was not a very, it's not a robust, that robust a project. With respect to a field like Prudhoe Bay or even Kuparuk, where you have very large reserves to develop, because when you have large reserves to produce, then the cost per barrel, since now here comes into barrels per day, is going to be less, because there's going to be certain fixed costs that you're not going to get away from, that you're going to be that you're going to incur regardless of the size of the reserve below the ground, and that, you know. That's just going to be part of it. But dollars, I mean cents per barrel, do make a difference on the lifting cost in determining whether that's going to be a marginal field. And the margin has to do with the economics. And the economics have to do with the cost to produce and to develop and the size of the reserve originally in place and then what you think can be recoverable. For instance, I told you that we think in Prudhoe Bay that we're going to recover about 44% of the original reserves in place. When you move over to Kuparuk, that's aerially a bigger field. It's spread out a whole lot larger than Prudhoe Bay is. But the reserves there are somewhere on the order of 4.5 to 5.5 billion barrels in place. And we're not going to recover near as much out of that as we feel that we are in Prudhoe Bay, and you know, we're on a on about a 30% recovery over in that particular field versus, you know, if you want to say 5 billion, we're going to recover 1.5 billion, so that's 30%, but that's 14% less than what we're going to get in Prudhoe Bay. So that makes a difference too as to how many of the reserves you will recover. And there's a whole bunch of variables that you get thrown into the marginal field. But the most important thing is how much is it going to cost you to develop that field and produce it. And that has to do with what you have to project out into the future as to a big variable is the price of oil and what it's going to cost you. And one of the biggest pieces in that, of course, is the taxes that will be paid, both to, like, a windfall to the federal government, or then, of course, naturally, the state taxes. So you can change a field's perspective real quick. And the only point's a good example.
Mr. Chairman, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. In other words, I guess what has been said, that when I look at a marginal field, I look in terms of the reserve and the potential, and we'd have to determine what that is to make a marginal field. And you're basically saying that, and we talked about the markets and whatnot, that there is no definition of a marginal field as far as you're concerned.
The park sitting there by itself without Prudhoe Bay was a marginal field because you couldn't have built taps to develop it. Now we have taps. Now we can define a little bit further margin, because without taps we couldn't have gone to Endicott either, or Lisburn. Well, we could Lisburn because it's within the Prudhoe Bay unit, but or Seal, which is right there, and Seal's sitting there for that very reason. Same size as Endicott. It's further offshore, in deeper water, twice as deep of water, 20 foot versus 10. We're 3.5 miles offshore. They're about 7. That accelerates and makes their cost of development much more. And so when they put those costs in there to develop the same size of reservoir that we're doing at Endicott, it puts it out of the ballpark on return with the same price structure that you're going to forecast for revenues. If you want my oil field definition of a marginal field in Alaska, because it's going to be different than it is in the lower 48 because the cost of doing business down there, both in development and expense, is a lot less. In Alaska, I would say you're looking at a marginal field that's going to be anything that's going to be somewhere between 500 million barrels of recoverable oil or less. If it's offshore, it's going to have to exceed. I mean, we're within state waters in Endicott, and Seal's not that far off. But now if you're going to get out into deeper water, where we are right now in the Sail 87 area, now you're, and when we drill Muckluck, that type of a field, in order to keep it from being marginal, is going to have to exceed 1 billion barrels of recoverable oil or more in order to be economical.
I think I finally figured this out in my area of the country. If I translate barrels into humpies and catch them off the dock, mm-hmm. you catch them in the ocean, it makes a difference, and how many pump through the plant makes a difference. So I think with that, I would just like to end here. I committed to getting people to lunch before noon. It's one thing that I have a few control over. So we'll come back at 1:30, and I'd like to get through the state corporate and individual income tax that we vote this afternoon. And so we get that wrapped up, and that'll be the separate accounting discussion. With that, we're adjourned until 1:30. Ready to get started again. Call the Joint Special Committee on Tax Policy back to order. to get through, we'll continue the definition or discussion of what a marginal oil field is on for ad infinitum. Take it up over beer after the meeting tonight. But right now we want to go on to an overview of the state corporate and individual income tax. Deborah Holt is going to take us through some of that. Some of it's a little bit of theory for those of us who still are slow uptake on the theory. And then I guess we'll ask Greg, are you going to join her? Are you available for questions?
I am available.
Okay, and maybe some of the other questions later on about actual numbers of what we have and what we're talking about. So Deborah, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Prepared outline discusses more or less the parameters of income tax, both for personal and corporate income taxes, and I sense a little sentiment in this room to get straight to the good stuff and go talk about separate accounting for oil and gas, but bear with me while we labor through some of the more introductory materials. Starting from the very beginning, income tax liability is composed of three components. What is the jurisdiction's definition of income? We have certain gut senses of what net income is as opposed to gross income, but there's no cast in stone definition of net income, so that's one inquiry that goes into the computation. The second one is if an individual or a corporation earns income in more than one taxing jurisdiction, how much of that income is earned in the taxing state? And that's the separate accounting, modified apportionment, worldwide combination, the more difficult concepts. And the final component is obviously the tax rate to which that resulting income is applied. That's the simplest of the three components of the computation. In your packages, you'll see an overview of the tax rates that Alaska, both as a territory and a state, has used, both for individuals and corporations. This should be right behind the outline after the tab mark income tax. And you can see that we have almost always, at least since 1958, treated corporations and individuals a little bit differently. The first thing to notice about this chart is that in the early days, we levied a tax on federal tax liability, not on federal...
Just a second. We got a...
I'm sorry.
We're having a hard time finding packets here.
This book.
Yeah. Just a second. Did you get one, Terry?
Yeah.
Okay, well, maybe we'll give Representative Martin a minute to catch up with this. Yeah, sir. Oh, I want to interrupt for a minute anyway here. Just for the record, while we were talking about the economic limit factor, we did receive a letter addressed to Senator Ferguson as chairman of the committee from Harold Hines from ARCO Alaska that they wanted entered in the record, and I just made copies and handed out to all the committee members. And Peggy, you can put that in with the record. So we have that on the ELF issue. Now for up to speed, everybody at the starting marks. Okay, thank you. Ever continue.
Thank you. I also intended to say that I am going to go through this initial material kind of rapidly, and I would be delighted if anyone interrupted me if I went too fast or covered something that you'd like to talk about in more depth. On this chart of income tax rates, the chart only shows changes, so that for all the years that don't appear, the tax rate was what it was in the years preceding. The first four entries show a percentage of federal tax, and that means that we levied our tax not on federal taxable income, but rather on federal tax liability. So that on the corporate side, by 1957, we had reached a rate of 18% of federal tax. That translates to an effective tax rate of approximately 9%, because the federal corporate tax rate is 50%. So that when we changed to a direct tax, actually it wasn't until 75, of 5.4% plus a 4% surtax on federal taxable income, it was really a fairly revenue-neutral change from approximately a 9% effective tax rate to a 9.4%. So that you can see on the corporate side, we really haven't changed our tax rate since 1957. The individual side, when we went to taxing federal taxable income instead of federal tax, that had the effect of divorcing Alaska's system from the graduated system that's already incorporated in federal tax liabilities. So that's when we changed to a graduated tax for the personal income tax on that side of the chart. The next component of the calculation is what is taxable income. And you start from the proposition that a gross receipts tax is legal, is constitutional. And as a result, from a legislative perspective, deductions against gross receipts are really a matter of legislative grace. We have certain gut senses of what net income is. Certainly, if you're taxing a manufacturing enterprise, you're going to allow deductions for the cost of labor and typical costs of doing business. But I think it's worth noting that our sense of what net income is varies pretty tremendously between corporations and individuals. Corporations are more or less taxed on sort of what's left over at the end of the year after they pay all their expenses. Certainly, I wish I could pay my taxes that way. The major consideration in determining what is taxable income is whether, and if so, to what extent, to incorporate the federal definitions of taxable income. And states and Alaska have taken a variety of approaches to that question. On the one extreme, the simplest thing to do is simply incorporate all the federal rules, say anything they allow as a deduction is automatically incorporated into our tax structure, tax credits are automatically incorporated, and by doing so, you have effectively bought the United States Congress's tax policy. At the far extreme on the other end is to develop completely separately the state's own definition of allowable deductions to reach net income. Alaska has walked a path somewhere in between by starting with federal taxable income and making certain adjustments to that income. For example, we add back in foreign taxes paid. We currently treat intangible drilling costs differently than they are treated by the federal government and so on. The advantages of tracking the federal system are obviously that it's easiest to administer. You have the added auditing capacity, as it were, of the United States. If your tax return you have to file in Alaska includes a copy of your federal return, that return is subject to the greatly enhanced auditing capacities of the United States. It's more difficult to cheat, is the point. Also, the rules and regulations, at least up until this major revolution that we've had this year, are pretty well understood. People, there are tax rulings on certain applications of the law to certain situations and so on. As I mentioned before, the disadvantage is that you buy off on federal policy, and it may or may not be appropriate for the state. Differences, well, the corporate taxable income is often very different from corporate book income. And this year, we're aware of the United States making substantial changes in the federal tax law, which, at least for corporations, takes steps toward narrowing the gap between book income and federal taxable income. Most of these differences are what taxpayers call timing differences, or early depreciation, a deduction taken in 1 year that then cannot be taken in a later year. Some of the differences have been a complete loss in the tax base in the form of tax credits and so on. Investment tax credits come into that category. They're not timing differences. They're never recovered by the taxing authorities. In the late 70s, when the income tax was under scrutiny, there was a great deal of concern about what the Department of Revenue called the erosion of the federal tax base. And that really is the difference between book income and federal taxable income. I sort of always get a kick out of Congress every year publishing these comparisons between federal taxable and book, and there are great newspaper stories about how this corporation and that corporation are paying, earned massive amounts of money and are only paying a tiny percentage of that amount in taxes, and certain congressmen get a lot of press on that and so on, and the impression is that these people are cheating on their taxes, but what they're doing, of course, is just taking advantage of all the rules that Congress had, that those same congressmen have adopted over the years, and calculating their income according to those rules. The erosion to the federal tax base that was of great concern in the late 70s, I think has largely been accounted for in Alaska's law. There are some provisions that at that time were industry-wide, like early depreciation and so on, and some differences that were specific to the oil industry, such as the expensing of intangible drilling costs rather than the capitalization and depreciation of them, and percentage depletion. Over the years, our tax law has adjusted those differences so that taxpayers under Alaska law right now must capitalize their intangible drilling costs. The state never did incorporate the Accelerated Cost Recovery Act for oil and gas taxpayers. When we went to modified apportionment in 1981, we required them to use depreciation as it stood before that time. And percentage depletion must be recalculated as cost depletion under Alaska's law. So I think that's one sort of major old policy consideration that is has largely been eliminated. The obvious next question is, what about the new federal law? And I think that on the whole, for most corporate taxpayers, what you should see is a slight or an increase in the federal definition of what is net income. The United States as a whole expects to gain revenue from corporations. They have lowered the corporate tax rate. The only way they can gain revenue and lower the tax rate at the same time is to increase the amount of income that they're taxing, and they've done that by repealing the investment tax credit, by tightening up depreciation law, depreciation rules. Intangible drilling costs, I believe, are still deductible up to 70% under the new law, but wouldn't be under Alaska's current law. So as a general rule, we should see our corporate taxpayers overall having a higher federal taxable income as a result of the federal tax changes. I think the Department of Revenue is in the process of examining these changes at some length, and will be providing some information in the near future. Those are the considerations then in what is the tax base that you're going to apply your tax rate to. The third category is the most difficult one, and that is how to divide up the income of a taxpayer that does business in more than one jurisdiction. As far as individuals are concerned, there are historically two ways that states have done it. One, they can tax on income earned within the state, or the other is that they can tax on the basis of citizenship and tax the income of their citizens wherever it's earned, and regardless of whether it was earned in the taxing state. The United States does that for corporations. They tax their domestic corporations on their worldwide income rather than on just their United States income. The corollary of that approach is generally to permit tax credits for taxes that are paid on that income in other jurisdictions. But for example, if the tax rate in another jurisdiction were 5% and our tax rate was 10%, then we would tax the other 5%. Multi-state taxpayers have not generally been taxed by states on the basis of citizenship. They've generally been taxed on the basis of identifying the amount of income that a taxpayer does within the state, regardless of where the corporation is incorporated or where it has its corporate domicile. For corporations, there are two traditionally basic ways to divide up the net income: apportionment and separate accounting. Separate accounting attempts to treat in-state income, the in-state portion of a taxpayer's overall income, as though it were a separate entity, as though that were the only business that the taxpayer were conducting. Formula apportionment, on the other hand, looks at all of the income that the taxpayer earns everywhere and attributes a part of that income to the taxing state on the basis of certain indicators of business presence, most commonly payroll, property, and sales. So that if 10% of your payroll, 10% of your property, and 10% of your sales are in the taxing jurisdiction, apportionment will tax 10% of your income. We just had lunch with six people and the check came at the end, and we could have divided it up based on the actual dollar amount for each entree. That would be separate accounting. Instead, we counted the number of people at the table and divided that into the check. That's more or less apportionment by formula. There, in the materials, some hypotheticals, and I don't know how much detail to go into on these, that just illustrate the ways in which the different approaches will divide up income. And the hypotheticals are set up to illustrate a couple of different points. The first one, which is the hypothetical retail sales taxpayer, hypothesizes a horizontally integrated business, a department store chain, a hotel chain, something like that, that the taxpayer is doing a similar kind of business in each of three different jurisdictions. And in this hypothesis, the business in state A and B are identical, and the business in state C is twice as big. you might look at the top part of this page as a simplified federal tax return. It shows their gross income, the company's overall gross income, total payroll costs, total other costs, and total net income. That would be the federal taxable income calculations that you would start with in using an apportionment formula. In this hypothesis, I have divided up those costs and income equally between states A and B and doubled them for state C, just to illustrate the point that even though state C is twice as big as state A and B, the formula will attribute according to the relative magnitude of the business done, so that state A is going to end up with a quarter of the income, state B with a quarter, and state C with half, because that's the way the hypothesis works. The next page shows how separate accounting might treat that same taxpayer. And in the first example, we see the same gross income that appeared as sales in the apportionment example as the starting point in states A, B, and C. The payroll costs we also knew from the formula, and they appear in the same proportion in states A, B, and C. And the other costs are then divided up on that same basis, so that you can see in this example, separate accounting and formula apportionment come to the identical result. The point here being that there isn't any particular inherent bias in one system or the other. It's perfectly possible that a change from one method to the other does not affect the actual taxes that the taxpayer pays. Example 2 shows separate accounting, except that I have moved some of the costs out of state C and put them in states A and B. Now, costs don't go into the formula apportionment calculation. So these, I just hypothesized in example 1 that the costs would follow the same fractions as the other elements that do appear in the formula. In example 2, we've just moved $1,000 of the costs over to states A and B, $500 in each jurisdiction. So that you can see by assigning more costs to state A and B, all of a sudden A and B are only making, I guess this is $500,000 instead of $1 million, and state C's income has now gone from $2 million to $3 million. And this is one of the elements that gives tax authorities nightmares about separate accounting, because these costs are not easily auditable. They can tax authorities believe that taxpayers can shift costs wherever they want and pile up all the costs in the heavy tax jurisdictions, assign none of the costs to the jurisdiction in which the tax burden is heavier, and come up with reduced tax liability in heavy tax states, and assigning all their income to states that either don't have income tax. Well, they don't even have to do that, because states don't communicate one to another, so the tax authorities always have nightmares that the tax return filed in state A added to the tax returns filed in all the other states will not total the total income over here on the federal tax return. And that's what tax authorities call nowhere income. And it makes them very leery of the separate accounting approach. Example 3 carries that idea one step further and attributes now just another $500,000 worth of cost to each of states A and B. All of a sudden, A and B earned no income whatsoever, and all of the income for the total corporate activity is assigned to state C. Taxpayers have traditionally, over the years, taken the position that separate accounting more accurately represents their income than does formula apportionment. It's more consistent with the way they keep their books. If you owned a hotel chain in 8 different states, you would probably keep separate books for each of those hotels and have a sense of how profitable each one was compared with the others. It is, from the taxpayer's perspective then, it's quite possible that, for example, example 2 might be the way that taxpayer's income actually looked to that taxpayer. So that, in fact, the operation in State C was a fair amount more profitable than the operations in States A and B. If you go back to the formula on page 1 is going to attribute the income that's set out there, no matter what the taxpayers' books show, whether they the taxpayers' books show example 1, example 2, or example 3, the formula is going to attribute the income as it appeared on page 1. So that a lot of the litigation about formula apportionment has been because the taxpayers have said their books resembled those in example 2 or 3, and the tax authorities have said they're going to tax on the basis of the first hypothetical with the apportionment formula. Of course, the taxpayer doesn't raise that argument in State C, where his books show that he made more money than the state is taxing. He raises that argument only in States A and B, where the state has him earning money that his books don't show that he earned. The next hypotheticals deal with a vertically integrated business, and this gets a little bit more complex. This hypothesis is of a manufacturing enterprise that manufactures a product in State A. For the purpose of the hypothetical, we're assuming that the manufacturer transfers all of his product to State B, where it is where the taxpayer then incurs marketing and sales costs, and all of his sales then, in the hypothesis, occur in State B. When separate accounting applied to this kind of a taxpayer has to establish a transfer value for the value of the commodity when it leaves State A. It's not sold in State A, it goes to State B for sale. And so there has to be a transfer value set up between the two entities. And for oil production, for example, that's wellhead value. On the separate accounting books, then, the transfer value becomes gross income for the state in which the product is manufactured and a cost of goods for in the accounting in the state in which the goods are sold. So the accounting goes like this. You've got the transfer value times the number of products as gross income in State A, less the cost of production, leaving net income in State A. In State B, gross income is the actual third-party retail sales price. The costs include the transfer value, which is the cost of goods, plus the sales cost, and in this hypothesis, leaving an identical amount of income from each of those activities in each of the two states. Down at the bottom, you see how apportionment would treat that same taxpayer. For the purposes of the hypothesis, assume that half of his payroll is in each of the activities, half in manufacturing and half in sales, but that all of his property is in manufacturing, and that all of his sales, obviously, are in State B. So the average of the fractions on each side is still one half. And here again, in this example, and it would be highly unlikely that this would happen in life, but it is theoretically possible that separate accounting and formula apportionment will reach the identical result. Again, on the next page, fiddle with the hypotheticals a little bit and see what happens when you change that transfer value. The transfer value on page 1 was $5 a unit. If you lower it to $4 a unit, and this is a private number. It's a number that the manufacturing arm of the business establishes vis-a-vis the sales arm. And suppose the taxpayer reports to you now that his transfer value is $4 a unit. His gross income then in State A has gone from $5,000 down to $4,000 because that's the basis on which you calculate his gross income. Now he has zero income in State A, and all of his income has been transferred to State B by altering that transfer value number. This is the other nightmare that tax administrators have, because artificially setting that transfer value too high or too low moves income from one jurisdiction to another in separate accounting. The apportionment formula treatment of the same entity is exactly the same as it was in the previous page. It does, and that's one of the main advantages of an apportionment formula is that the transfer value is taken out of the calculation. And it doesn't matter where the taxpayer sets that transfer value for his own purposes, the formula doesn't take it into account. And so income can't be shifted by manipulating that number. A concept that I wanted to bring in today that I don't think we've ever talked about in any of these hearings is that of worldwide combination. And I'd like to just discuss it briefly and show how it relates to the ideas of separate accounting and formula apportionment. If you go back to the hypothetical on page 1A, we talked about a horizontally integrated business that does business in three different states. You could hypothesize that state C, instead of being a state, is another country. And by simply looking at the math in the example, you can see that it doesn't matter whether you were to, that was all domestic income in states A and B, and apportion it by a formula. You then would have states A and B each under a formula attributing half of what's now only $8,000 in income between those two states. If you add on into the formula the activities in the foreign country, it doesn't necessarily change the tax result in state A or state B. You can sort of keep adding increments on indefinitely, so long as profitability is relatively uniform throughout the corporate business as a whole. If you look at the variations on the next page, you can see that it would matter to the taxpayer if the income from the foreign jurisdiction were taxed by separate accounting in the foreign jurisdiction, because then you would have income attributed under one of these examples as being perhaps higher than would be attributed under the formula when separate accounting is used by the foreign jurisdiction and formula apportionment is used by the in-state jurisdictions. A lot of taxpayers feel that they're being exposed to excessive taxation. The point is that there's nothing inherent in the formula that makes it come out that way. The only time that separate accounting and formula apportionment come to different results is if profitability is not uniform within the enterprise as a whole. If the foreign operations are vastly more profitable than the domestic operations, then using worldwide combination will increase the tax burden domestically. And you're never going to get taxpayers and tax administrators to agree on what's on distortions like that. The taxpayers are always going to argue that more of their income was earned outside of your reach, and the state's always going to take the other side, and I don't expect that we'll see an end to that sort of litigation. The concept of worldwide combination has been in the forefront nationally in the last several years subsequent to the decision in Container Corporation versus Franchise Tax Board of California, in which the taxpayer there argued that because foreign jurisdictions use separate accounting, and because his income earned in foreign jurisdictions was taxed by separate accounting, the inclusion in California's calculations of that foreign income overly attributed income to California. The United States Supreme Court held that the use of the method by California was not only constitutional, but rational and rationally related to the taxpayer's contacts within the state, so that it opened the door, or it gave the United States Supreme Court stamp of approval to the worldwide combination approach. This has resulted in a tremendous amount of political activity on the basis of foreign trading partners who have testified or presented their position that the worldwide unitary approach is a disincentive to investment in the United States. And there's been a nationwide presidentially appointed working group to try to work out some solution to what these people see as a problem. I think the point I'd like to make here is that Alaska has been a worldwide unitary combination state for some time, and it is now. I think there are now only two other states that use the method, and I think we are the only state in the United States that has not had legislation, at least proposed, to repeal worldwide combination. I don't know what the revenue impacts are of using or not using the method. I expect that they're not great, or they're not great in the state's favor, or we would have heard some of our taxpayers kicking and screaming. They haven't been kicking and screaming in Alaska, and that's probably why we haven't seen any legislation to that effect. But it's worth considering whether that's a subject that a tax policy committee should investigate. There are two elements to the worldwide combination theory. The first is the worldwide aspect of it, and the second is the combination. And worldwide means that you look at, you don't stop at the edge of the United States when you look at a taxpayer's income. The combination part means that you look not only at the corporation which is doing business in your jurisdiction, but also at affiliated corporations. And so you tax, in the case of Standard Oil, you tax the parent and the domestic, the subsidiary that does business in Alaska, as well as subsidiaries that have no contact with Alaska. They are treated as one corporate family, and a chunk of that income is apportioned to the state on the basis of the formula factors that occur in the state. I just raised the point because it's related to separate accounting and modified apportionment, and I think it may be worth some investigation by this committee. Turning to separate accounting for oil companies, I've given you a lot of reasons why formulas are wonderful and why tax administrators think that they're terrific. Ease of administration, inability of the taxpayers to shift profitability around by shifting costs or altering transfer values. We threw all this out in 1978 and adopted separate accounting for oil and gas taxpayers. As early, I think, as 1971, the legislature began to hear testimony that the three-factor formula, the payroll, property, and sales formula, was not well designed for the oil industry. And there are a number of reasons, some of which came out in the legislature and some of which I became familiar with in the litigation. You have in your packets the long paper there, the affidavit of Edward Deacon, who was an accounting professor at the University of Texas, and his analysis or his affidavit walks through separate accounting and formula apportionment for oil and gas taxpayers in a great deal of detail. If you're more interested in this subject than I'm going to satisfy you, you might find it interesting reading. What the legislature learned was that none of the three factors was particularly well designed to measure oil production activities. The property factor is probably the worst designed because it does not measure the value of the oil in the ground. Oil and gas taxpayers, or oil and corporations, are somewhat unique in that their most valuable asset, which is their reserves, does not appear on their books of account. There was a flurry of activity some years ago for reporting to the SEC, for book reporting, that would have required reserve recognition. But as I understand it right now, it's still not required. And when you look at the property that an oil company owns, it includes the wells, it includes the pipeline, it includes the hardware and so on, but it doesn't include the value of the oil. Estimates in front of the legislature in the late 70s indicated that Prudhoe Bay would appear in the property factor at approximately 2% of its actual value. The property factor is further distorted in the oil industry because of the federal rules for the deduction of intangible drilling costs rather than the capitalization. As I understand it, these rules encourage oil companies to do business through subcontractors rather than through their own employees. And, excuse me, I'm talking about the payroll factor now. But the IDCs enter into the property factor because property that would otherwise be capitalized is expensed and as a result doesn't appear in the property factor. The payroll factor is does not work well because oil production as compared to refining and marketing is not labor intensive in the first place, and secondly, because these IDC rules encourage the oil companies to do business through subcontractors who don't appear in their payroll factor, whereas in the other activities against which production activities are measured, the work that's done in refining and marketing is more likely to be done by oil company employees. The sales factor obviously was not going to be very helpful to Alaska because very little of the oil was predicted to be sold in the state, as indeed it has been. And to my mind, it's most effective because it doesn't measure the magnitude of production in it,